There is such beauty in this silence. You don't feel like speaking, you know. The moment you speak, it's over. But speaking has to happen.
It's part of the path.
Yeah.
It's what exposes false knowledge. It's what allows surrender to continually surrender yourself to. That's unconditional love. Is total surrender to what is. The absence of resistance.
And the beauty is that it is readily available. It is where everything starts. Yet we forget. Why we forget, I don't know. But we forget. And then, eventually we have to come back to it. Because this is our refuge.
Until it's seen that there is no separation between it and yourself. It's just the one speaking.
Start with a question.
Sure.
I have been biting my tongue for so long, right? Like these many days. Because all the questions were being asked by him. He wants to know everything about India and how does this work, how does that work, what does that mean, what does this mean, right? So during those conversations, one thing that really became pretty clear for me is his zeal to somehow bridge the gap between the East and the West and then how the mind structures really worked. Do you happen to have any, you know, learnings or insights into maybe through Jiddu Krishnamurti or whoever it is, somewhere someone had already attempted this and then figured, okay, you know, if the message is this way, probably that is more appealing to the West, but if the message is this way, it's probably appealing to the East, things like that.
Yes, I think Jiddu Krishnamurti himself used to say that when you go to India, you will hear the Indian version. When you come to West, you will get the Western version. Mm. Then there is one version which is, I don't know what it's called, radical non-duality or something like that.
Mm.
That is also another version. So I'm not very particularly fond of this word non-duality as such. Like I don't say that I am a non-dualist. So for heaven's sake, don't call me a non-dualist.
Yeah.
The only thing I'm doing here is just sharing my insights, which I think have matched with what these teachers have said, like Jiddu Krishnamurti or Ramana Maharishi, or Ramesh Palsekar, or any other teacher for that matter. And but there is one thing which is clear in this, that maybe there are different paths we are taking, but the destination is same, whether you approach it through jnana, or you approach it through karma, or you approach it through bhakti, the devotion. They're all the same. Now my ancestors were from the path of devotion. So my great-great-grandfather was a spiritual teacher. My great-grandfather was a spiritual teacher also. They were Sikhs, and they were all in the path of devotion. And through that, that was their way of explaining and propagating the teaching. So yes, the cultural conditioning is there now that we have learned the language and we are more open because of technology to the Western audiences. So definitely, we have to speak it in a way so that a person in another country can understand it. Otherwise, there's a lot of Sanskrit shlokas written in the scriptures. you can keep reading all of that. But at some point, like for me, it was very clear that it has to be personal experience. Like, I know it sounds a bit, what is personal experience? But it has to be that.
It has to be direct.
Yeah, just to be direct.
And the West does have the bridging into the East through quantum physics and through psychology and neuroscience. So we can utilize that intelligence to bridge the gap, right? Because it all points to the one reality, right? And in their words, it's dark energy or the unified field. You know, it's something along those lines, but it's pointing to the one that's generating the many. And so utilizing those tools, those human generated knowledge tools, to bridge the gap from the mind into the heart.
True.
And to Robbie's point, it's like you have to start in the mind, right? For the West. The West needs substance. It needs credibility, right? It needs to trust something at least a little bit. And once you are able to do that, then you can start to cascade into the East's heart, from the mind, from the Western mind to the Eastern heart.
True. And even Ramesh Balsekar would say that never discount the intellectual understanding. It does bring a lot of peace. But yes, the final thing is actually the awakening of the heart. Mm-hmm. Because no intellectual knowledge is actually going to get you there, in the reality.
You have to be able to demonstrate that the heart has value, right? The heart is just a word in the States, in America. And it doesn't have direct meaning. It doesn't have true value to a Western mind. And it's demonstrating that it does. And how do we demonstrate that? How do we bridge that gap, that it has value and it's everything you've been seeking your whole life? That's the schooling. That's what we're trying to come up with a platform to bridge that gap.
Oh, it's wonderful. And what I see, like from my experience, what I see in the Western audience, there is a resistance to leave the intellectual capacity. When I say, just relax, just be. So they say, how do I relax? I say, there is no way to relax. Relax means to be.
Nobody does relax.
Yeah, nobody does. Nobody's ever alone. Nobody never relaxes. Right. And the problem with the Eastern audience is, actually it's way bigger than the Western audience. The problem is that they have heard all these Mahavakyas. I am that, that thou art, Aham Brahmasmi. But yeah, but they haven't gone through the path of self-contemplation or intellect, but they've heard it.
Yes.
So then they begin to justify it. They say, why are you sad? Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Why are you sad? But sadness is an arising. They feel the need to defend it. So I say that even if that route, if we are going through that route of intellectual knowledge first, either through jnana or through bhakti or through karma, that is perfect. It is the path that is destined for an individual, designed for an individual. But to jump to a conclusion is just the ego mind's way of, you know, trying to affirm what it already wants to believe.
Interesting.
Right. How do you dissolve into that? What is it that dissolves into the heart? And this is what we've been discussing, right? This sense of individualism. It's the sense. The West has a very, very strong sense of individualism, where I think it's so strong that for those of you who grew up in the East, you don't realize how strong that is. It's everything. And so letting that go is a big deal, because we just mistake this mind and body as our self, and that means that this has to die. The body has to die somehow at first, right? And that's when you first come into this message, that's the first conclusion. It's like, are you asking me to take my life? Because what does this mean? That I have to let go of my individualism. What does that even mean? And so it's helping those who are interested to understand what that means.
Yeah.
It's cool. Not your body that you let go of, it's your mind.
Yeah. I think it's got more to do with the fear that if my body is gone, that if then I will be pushed around, that I will be taken advantage of.
Yes.
There is a fear. And I mean, I don't know, I have seen even in the place from where I come, there is strong individualism.
Right.
Like, I come from the Punjabi family. Yeah. Now, again, when it comes to India, I see difference between North and South in that context.
Yes.
Like, when I went to Chennai and these places, I saw that there is more readiness to accept this idea, at least think about it. But in North, it is slightly different. In North, we are still at that stage where we think that body is all there is. Body has to be perfected. Body has to be... Now, I tell people that it is not that I'm telling you not to work out or not to... I mean, of course, you have to keep the vehicle intact.
Yeah.
Otherwise, how are you going to sit in meditation? How are you going to contemplate? You can't do any of that stuff.
It's your temple.
Yeah, it's your temple. But at the same time, it is not done with the objective of making it more to achieve something. It is just this understanding that yes, this is a vehicle, and this is the mind is also a part of that. But what you are is completely different.
Mm.
Just with that understanding, the whole thing changes. So like it's my conditioning to exercise, because I come from that family. From my father's side, my grandfather, they used to exercise a lot. So we did all of that. So I, as a ritual, I also do that. Even my children do that.
Yeah. But you're not trying to get anything out of it anymore.
Yes, yes. There is no emphasis. There is no future-oriented thinking that I have to protect myself from something, from some outcome, from some disease, from some... You know, of course, we exercise with this thing, you know, with this idea to keep ourselves healthy. But it does not come from that place where there is fear. It comes from that place where I can serve my family, I can serve others. Otherwise, if the body is not working, if the mind is not calm enough, nothing can ever be said, there will be no help, actually. So that is important. And most of the people mistake this when they are told you're not the mind and the body. This is where the panic, you know.
Oh, yes.
Oof, mind and body is saying, I am the mind, I am the body. I mean, I've heard people saying that, I am the mind, I am the body. And I get your point when you say that it is there in the West, like it is embedded deep. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of competition. And I heard somebody, I can't recall who, but he said all the great things, the great teachings have been a cooperative effort. It has never, it has been a cooperative and a collaborative effort. It has never been a competitive effort as such. Mm-hmm. If you see all the big things, you know, the infrastructure, the railways, you know, what they had achieved in the past, electricity, there was no one genius who did all of that. There were people who worked. Mm-hmm. And they kept themselves fit. You know, the farmers in the field who laid out those tracks, they kept themselves fit. I mean, I see those old Hollywood classics. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful. And there was no confusion about the roles that different people played in that time. But now it's very different. But again, that's the nature of life. I mean, changes happen. And yes,
yeah.
We are trying to form this bridge. And we can just give our ideas.
Yeah.
That's it. That's where it ends. I mean, but again, it's only the source which decides. The awareness decides.
Yes.
Relatively speaking.
Yeah.
It's like having competition without desire for outcome.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's competition with no need to obtain anything from it.
Yeah.
Because you already are everything. You don't need anything else. But that competition, we could just say, is just life happening. We just put a label on it as competition, but it's just life happening.
Yeah, true. And, you know, when we operate with that sense, that there's not anything special to this, what we're doing. We're just doing it because it brings a sense of satisfaction. You know, when you talk about the one, it actually gives you bliss. And that is the only reason you talk about it. You don't talk to enlighten anybody. You know, you don't do that. You don't try to force anybody, you know, that it has to be this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But can we provide examples in terms of,
of course,
like, say, in West, there is a predominant belief that whatever the West is because of that, the trained mind over the time, they developed the thought and purified it, not purified, but refined it.
Yeah.
Refined it over, and then it is a process, and they continue to do it in order for them to really create whatever they have achieved so far. So they take a lot of pride in that.
Right.
So, but there are two different ways of looking at it. Like, any great thing that anywhere was achieved, it is the universal thought,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But not to confuse that with individual stream of thoughts that are kind of like happening, right? So is there an example to say, yeah, that is true for universal thought, but let me tell you where thought can fail you, and then
yeah,
give one or two examples for them to at least to turn them around to say.
I say this simple thing,
yeah,
when people claim the idea of greatness is of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
The mind wants to feel great about a certain thing,
yes,
whether it is in scriptural knowledge, the spiritual knowledge, the religious knowledge, or it is the infrastructure of the high-tech gadgets or whatever. The idea of greatness and, you know, not greatness, whatever you call it, is of the mind.
Yeah.
Now I tell people, but are you at peace?
Mm.
You don't have to answer this question. Don't never answer this question. just see, watch, just observe what is happening when you ask, are you at peace?
Mm-hmm.
If you are not at peace, there is no point to any greatness. There is, you can keep reading the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Gita. You can keep, I have seen people, you know, who can just recite all the shlokas of Bhagavad Gita, yet they are so restless within. It's pointless. Any great achievement is pointless if you don't have peace of mind. So what is your fundamental value? That is the big question. What is it that you are really after? Now, in some people's case, it is their destiny to keep repeating a pattern.
Seems to be a lot of people's destiny.
Ah, I see. Yeah, true, very true. I mean, I meet them every day. And the pattern repeats, the pain repeats, the suffering repeats. It's a never-ending cycle. But at some point, you know, it begins to dissolve. Either the mind stops paying attention, you know, mind stops being vigilant, or the body starts giving up.
Yes.
It happens. As we age, you know, this whole pride in the great things that we have achieved, it begins to actually, we begin to question it, you know. My grandfather, he recently passed away during COVID. He was 98 years old. And he had been reading Guru Granth Sahib, our holy Sikh scripture, his entire life. And now when that man at the age of 96 says, it's all useless, you know, that means 96 or 95, I don't remember, when the Uttarakhand floods happened, you know.
Oh, the cloud burst?
I think so, yeah. When the Uttarakhand, I remember him, he was so disgusted, he just threw his paper and he said, there is no God. Now we know where that comes from.
Yeah.
But you see, at some point, the mind begins to challenge. It reverts on itself. And I get a lot of emails from people where they tell me that they're going through this phase. Now, again, some masters call it dark night of the soul or the spiritual crisis or spiritual depression, whatever you want to call it. But that suffering which one goes through has a purpose. And I feel that without that, that final connection to the heart cannot happen. I mean, at least I have not seen anybody who could simply jump from an intellectual knowledge directly to the heart. I mean, I had the intellectual knowledge even 5-6 years back. But there was never this shift. There was never this jump. Unless and until I put up my hands and I said, I don't want anything to do with Advaita. And then it happened.
Huh.
I didn't even realize what was happening. I was happier, I was becoming happier day by day. I felt more peaceful. I started connecting to people deeply. I've never connected, I never used to connect with people. So these changes started happening. And then there was no need for me to, I didn't feel the need to actually seek anything or to know anything, to get any answer. Yes, I go to my teachers, my elders, you know. I listen to Gautam. You know?
Oh yeah, Sachdeva.
Yeah, Gautam Sachdeva. I mean, he's like an elder brother.
Yeah.
And it's very peaceful in his company. And of course, his wisdom is there. But again, it is not there to learn anything. That thing has dissolved.
Yes.
That's the counterintuitive piece of it.
Yes.
This isn't something new you're adding to yourself. This is a letting go.
Yeah.
Right? And you know, to your grandfather's, you know, none of the scriptures matter, right? That's a profound, profound statement. That is understanding what everything is that needs to be let go, right? We don't, at first, you're like, I don't even know what that means. What do I let go? And then you start to realize, whoa, there's a lot to let go. And then you get down really, really, really intimate. And you're like, whoa, I've got to let everything go. I've got to let Ramana Maharshi go and the scriptures go and God go. Everything has to go. Everything. Before you realize, before you come back to it, so to speak. But you don't come back to it here, it remains here, right? Everything, it's the paradox of letting go. As you let go of it intellectually, it becomes you. So everything you let go of actually becomes yourself.
Yeah.
It becomes extremely intimate, right? And once you get a taste of that, right? You get a taste of that letting go, and then all of a sudden, whatever you let go of is right here. That can generate a cycle, you could say, of understanding what letting go is and letting go is and letting go is.
As this letting go happens, you find yourself peaceful.
Yes.
And the questions begin to dissolve.
Yes.
So people actually come with, when they come with questions, I tell them I'm not here to answer questions. I'm here to ask you, where are the questions coming from?
Mm.
Because otherwise, it's the nature of mind. Mind doesn't want freedom. Mind wants entanglement. Mind wants debate. Mind wants to argue. That is how it perpetuates itself. You know, it wants to get hold on something. So if it says neti neti, not I, not I, then it gets attached to not I, not I. That is what Ramana Maharishi said, that even that is not going to help. He said nothing absolutely is going to help.
Yes.
Yeah, there lies the trouble, right? Like, it appears like we are talking on both sides, in the sense like, you are not peaceful the way you are, and nothing is going to help you. So, it's going to put a lot of, you know, the people in a quandary, like, you know, then what am I supposed to do?
That is the thing. The whole idea of doership is deeply embedded in us. That is the whole problem. I mean, I think this question, just yesterday someone on YouTube asked me this question, that if everything is God's will, what am I supposed to do then? Then I said, do whatever you think you should do, you know, do whatever you want to do. In any case, your doing does not matter.
Yeah.
But this idea of doership, that I can do something about it, I can do something to be from this point, where the points are also there in imagination. So,
yeah, it's like a noose.
Yeah.
Right? That you're pulling this noose, and this loop is getting smaller and smaller and smaller until it pulls itself free.
Yeah.
And it will, you know, at first we have these big loops. We move away from ourselves. In fact, we spiral off and we don't know how to come back. But once somebody shows us, oh, come back to yourself, come back to yourself, come back to yourself, they get smaller and smaller. But that's all doing,
yeah.
Right? The very last little infinitely small loop has to be done by grace.
Yes.
Right? That is that last little teeny, teeny bit of doer left in us that only from the direct experience of turning your attention into your own being and seeing you prefer to be there than this little last piece of doership, that's when it dissolves, and that's when you realize, oh, there never was a doer. There didn't need to be a doer. Right? But you've got to get that, like you can, the ego will get this small. It will get that small, but it's not until you directly experience yourself and that grace pulls that last loop through, right? The chit jada granthi is untied.
True.
So And that's when you realize, oh, there never was an ego. There never was a person.
Yeah.
And there didn't need to be. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Everything's okay.
You know, trying to convince people of letting go of that last bit is like, you know, telling, like dreaming and telling yourself that the dream is not real, you know?
Say that again.
Like, for example, if you're dreaming, and in dreaming you are a spiritual seeker, and you say, I want enlightenment. And in your dream, you know, somebody comes and say, wake up. So wake up. So in the dream, you can't wake up, you know. But the moment you wake up, you see, there was no dream, nothing. There was no other person. There was no this, no that. It was all the same. So when that waking up happens, is not in the individual's control, it cannot be given by a guru. Guru can only point. Teacher can only point. So that is what teachers do. They only point. Beyond pointing is doership.
Yes.
Anything beyond pointing becomes doership.
And that's... The real question is... I go back to what Murugunar asked Ramana Maharshi when to write... Uludu Narpadu. He said, enlighten what the one reality is and the means to obtain it. So there's two pieces to that. And it's fairly easy to talk about the exposure of the one, right, in words that we talk about. But it's what everybody's truly after, who's in this seeking, is the means to obtain it. Yes. What are the means? How do I get there? I'm all in. I'm all here. Yes, I love that I am in. But how do I pull that last loop, which again is completely counterintuitive because you can't do it. That's the surrender, right? The self-inquiry and the surrender is somewhat happening simultaneously there.
I think path of self-inquiry and surrender are not two, actually. They seem like separate two things, but eventually even self-inquiry leads to surrender. I mean, that has been my experience, that until and unless I was convinced that I cannot do anything about it, I mean, deep.
Yeah.
That was, before that, I did not know what love means. Yeah. Only after that, I started loving people. Mm-hmm. I started knowing what love is. And for me, there's nothing more important than love. And this word has been grossly misunderstood by people around the world.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
And the whole emphasis, that's why, you know, when I'm talking, I sometimes stress on relationships. Now, the traditional Advaita teachers do not talk much about it. Of course, I don't consider myself to be a teacher in any way. I just speak what I experience. And with relationships, this is the only way to have a chance at that love. Of course, relationships are going to be turbulent, they're never going to be harmonious, there's going to be disharmony, but that disharmony is, the basis of that is also love. Mm-hmm. And that is the only gateway to surrender, otherwise surrender does not happen, otherwise people are stuck in their loops.
It's learning how to fall in love with love.
Yes.
And once you fall in love with love, it's all over. There's nothing more that's...
Try saying that out loud and expect people to get that. Fall in love with love.
Fall in love, and it's falling in love with yourself.
Yeah.
It's giving yourself the permission to fall in love with yourself and not your egoic self, right? This needs to be clarified. It's falling in love with your own existence.
Sat Chit Ananda, being consciousness bliss.
Explain that a little bit. I think actually he would be very interested in knowing that concept as well.
Yeah. See, I honestly don't know much about it because I've not studied scriptures or anything like that. But what I understand is that these three are not separate. Being is consciousness, and consciousness is bliss. And bliss is readily available. It is not the bliss, the worldly bliss that we talk about, you know, which we, the bliss that we have after drinking wine or after
spirituality.
That's an experience.
And that's an experience. Mm-hmm. But this is, this bliss is what illuminates the experience. And sometimes, you know, even I fall short of words. I don't have words to explain it. There's no way you can explain it, actually.
No.
So, you know, when you are in each other's, when we are in each other's presence, and when there is silence like there was, that's bliss.
It's when consciousness becomes aware of its own existence.
Yes.
Bliss arises out of that.
Yeah. The being's nature is made up of knowing, and through that knowing it is known. So the whole duality of experiencer and experienced object, that all that creates confusion. That is why we begin this chase, let me do this, let me do that. But once you see that everything is just made up of pure knowing, it is pure, that is what Chit is, that is what Ananda is. Then the whole movement stops, because mind knows, at some point it gets to know. Now it's futile.
Now
I can't do anything. I've done everything, I've tried, I've read the scriptures, I've prayed, I've meditated, I've done this, done that. No, it doesn't help. Now what do I do? Then it says, who is the doer?
And when there's 100% conviction of what you just said, I would say that that's self-realization.
That is self-realization. The person never gets self-realized. It is not the person. The person keeps emerging, and its nature is to be in doubt and confusion. It's not that. It's just that there is this openness to a higher awareness. Huh? I don't know if I'm putting the right words, but this is the best I can do. There is some sort of higher awareness you open up to.
At the end of the day, all words fail us. Right?
Yes, true. That's why, you know, Ramana Maharishi said that silence is the highest teaching. Like, he would just sit silently, people would come close to him, and they knew, they would know what he's talking about. Mm. Or not talking about.
Yeah. And I think this is when we put everyone in jittery, like, you know, in jitters, right, saying, then how does the world sustain? How do I survive?
Well, look at the way you are sustaining the world right now.
I can hold it for a little bit longer.
I mean,
Atlas.
We're definitely not doing a very good job. I mean,
right. We can do better. Yeah.
I think the doership makes it more worse. I mean, we have polluted the environment. We still have wars. I mean, after all this spiritual teaching literature from all religions, from all over the world, we still have wars to this date. People are killing innocent children and women and old people. What does it show? That we are immersed in doership. We still feel that.
Actually, we degraded it because at least at a certain point of time in our conscience, we at least started with the dharma of never harming a person who is unarmed or who sought refuge, right? Or surrendered their arms.
Yeah.
Never harm anyone who is not armed.
Yeah.
But now it is not that. The nature of the war is like, it doesn't matter who it is, just decimate.
Yes.
Obliterate.
Now we are...
Annihilation.
Yes, now we are putting up a facade where we are saying we want peace, we want harmony. But we are not willing to take a deep look within what is going on. We are not willing to confront that monster. Until that happens, the dysfunction within will manifest as a dysfunction in the external world. This is what Jiddu Krishnamurti said, that what you see out there is not separate from what is happening within you. It is just a larger manifestation of that. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a spark within there, you see the fire, but the spark and the fire are one. So, the thing is, we want to be good people, we want to be law-abiding people, loving to our families, but sometimes we put so much pressure on ourselves.
Yeah.
So much pressure that we don't even realize that we are actually torturing ourselves, we are not loving ourselves. So, at some point, when the mind sees that doership is futile, what happens is that it reverts on itself. And that, according to me, is the beginning of self-love, true self-love. And then it finds that all there is the self, and the self by nature is love. So there is nothing to be done to attain it. It is just here. It is here and it is now. It is there when you are asleep, it is there when you are dreaming, it is there when you are waking. All your ability to experience comes from it. So it is beautiful. But then yes, we get pulled away, the conditioning operates. And yes, of course, that also happens because of the cosmic law.
But through the means, which is self-inquiry or surrender, it's the unceasing inquiry. Right, it's kind of like a training yourself to constantly remind yourself of the love of yourself, and that takes a while. I had sticky notes on my mirror. I have notes that go off every hour on my phone. I mean, you have to play with the tool you're given, which is this thing, at first, and you have to use it against itself.
Yes.
Right, so instead of spiraling off all the time in your thoughts and imaginations, how are you able to bring that back and remind and remind and remind and remind, and not just with your eyes closed in silence and self-inquiry, but out in your daily life when you're having a conversation with somebody,
yes.
You're like, remember, 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 as you're talking, you know, and as you're working.
That's
right.
A good
that
point.
Yeah.
I think actually, sorry, but I think the reason why I wanted to interject is there are two separate things out here that happen. But in your case, you wanted to be conscious all the while, like throughout the day, because you're, kind of like dispensing your responsibilities and all of that, and still you want to be in service of that.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, you shut the doors, you just locked yourself up for quite some time and just immersed and then pouring through all of that.
Yeah, you see, it's the same thing actually. The same thing was happening. You know, we both were creating the subject-object split, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is very natural part of this process, you know. The inquiry is a very natural part of the process. The thing is that every now and then, the mind comes up, the ego mind comes up, the vigilance comes up, that I must be attentive, you know, to the self. That is where this problem happens, that when you start objectifying that which cannot be, which is the pure subject, so you actually, it so happens, but you know, Ramana was very clear on this. He said that will happen. It's okay. Sometimes I will happen, you know, I reverting on itself as I. So he would say that even if you say that I, you know, if you use that word, I, right, it is still a thought. It is thought on itself. There is a separate I trying to contemplate on the eternal I, right? So there is still a separation. But then he said that eventually that bridge closes. It begins to close. So first there is all this intellectual reflection that goes on, you know, in daily living.
Mm-hmm.
So in this, you know, there was not much emphasis on meditation as such. The flow itself, the flow of life itself was considered to be a meditation. So when we're dealing with people, when we're talking to people, this whole process of inquiry happens. you know, why did they say this to me? Why did they say that to me? Okay, where is this me? Who is feeling hurt? Where is the hurt coming from? Is it coming from outside or is it within me? Mm-hmm. So this whole process happens over and over again. But slowly you understand that the entity which is claiming ownership of the sensations of the feeling is actually also an arising. And it is not constant. Like, it comes up, then it again subsides. It comes up. So I think that is why in Buddhism they say, you know, it is the gap between the two thoughts. It's very minute, you know. So there's a, how do I say this? Like, you know, some sage said that, you know, in the clouds, you know, when it's covered with the grey clouds, there are small openings of blue. So, but actually, it's not that those are small openings. It's all blue sky out there. And it's all love. I mean, eventually you realize it's all love. It does not mean that, you know, one gets immersed in love and never feels any emotion. It's not like that. The person keeps coming up. That is by design. That is by nature. And all those experiences, all those emotions, pain, everything happens the same. It's just that there is a deep understanding. Now, I'm trying to give a conceptual explanation. It's not going to help much. But the best way I try to conceptualize is that, just to explain my point, that earlier, before any of the seeking started, when I was living my usual life, you know, the contents were the main thing. And there was this very faint awareness in the background, but the content was the main. So partying, drinking, you know, shopping, or doing whatever I wanted to do to make myself happy. That was my main, that the content was the main thing for me. Then slowly it shifted. The awareness came in the foreground and the content moved backwards. Yes. Again, the same things would happen. I still would go to a party. I still would go for shopping or, you know, try to indulge in other things. But there was this constant awareness now that this is happening, right? Mm-hmm. So that awareness brought me back. Over and over, it kept bringing me back to itself. So the habits or anything of those nature did not sustain for longer period. Mm-hmm. So even if, let's say, somebody hurt me, right, I would feel hurt in the moment, but it did not sustain for long. Like, eventually there was no resentment towards anybody. There was no hatred towards anybody. The strong feelings didn't have the strength to go beyond that awareness. So that awareness was in the forefront.
Those are actually pointers, right? Because anything that creates resistance within yourself is a gift to remind yourself.
Yes.
Right? And that's the elimination of your vasanas.
Yes.
Right? Anytime
it
you can.
It keeps bringing you back to the awareness. Back to the awareness.
Yeah, I think you beautifully explained that with the situation with a neighbor and your son. Yeah, probably he is not aware of what I'm talking about.
I mean, it has happened with a lot of stuff. It has happened with my wife also, you know. Anisha,
the ground root, like the ball. What are you talking about? People playing cricket or no? Sorry, go ahead.
Anisha, no. With my son, that was the guard which was abusive towards my. He just, you know, he said something and the child was actually quite shaken up, and so I went. I held his collar actually, and the moment I held his collar, I looked into his eyes and I just saw his pain. Mm-hmm. And that moment it dropped. It dropped.
Instantaneous.
Now, I didn't want to say also anything to him any further.
Yeah.
Before that, there was anger, arising of anger. And this has happened with me two times. One time, there was a taxi driver. Now, you know, in Delhi, you do come across such odd situations.
I'm sure you do.
There are extra pointers here if you want.
Just go stand out on the street.
So there was, you know, we were standing in this lane, and this was many years back, and this was before actually I was into any of this teaching. So my in-laws were leaving the house, you know, and there was a taxi driver who came, who kept honking, you know. Now my wife told the taxi driver to just, you know, calm down. And he kept honking, honking. So I got furious, you know. So I went towards him again. I just held him like this. And in that instant, it just dropped. Now I didn't know what to do. You know, now he kept hurling abuses at me. Yeah. And, you know, he was in his full form. And I was feeling love. I was just not angry at all. There was no anger at all. I didn't know how to respond. And I was, you know, I just kept walking here and there. And, you know, he was honking, you saying, please move. Eventually he came, you know, eventually he looked at me and he said, and he went
up. Wow, that's amazing.
So yeah. this has happened even with my son. Now my son was shaken up in that instant. And, you know, I was very upset. I mean, I held his collar. But in that instant, like, it so happened that I could see the entire thing. That, you know, the moment you look into anybody's eyes, you see the separation ending. Mm. Now, the thought that came afterward was that this was a, you know, aged fellow. And okay, he had a reaction just as I'm having a reaction right now. He also had a reaction, something. Now, if I can definitely call the cops. Mm. But then, you know, this is India. He would lose his job. And I don't know, maybe he's the sole earning member, and
yeah,
it can be ugly.
Yeah.
So, of course, I gave him a warning and then mm-hmm. I left him. But yes, it so happened. It did happen. So the human part, it does not change as such. There are some changes do happen. But it's just that whatever happens, happens in the moment. The momentary reactions do happen sometimes. But overall, there is a peace. Like, you don't beat yourself up that, you know, what happened? I shouldn't have done this. I shouldn't have, you know, said, I should have handled it this way, that way. All that story begins to fade away. It begins to drop. You don't create any negative feeling towards yourself or towards the other person, because you know that it had to happen this way. There was no other way.
Interesting. So can that be a pointer in someone's life, in the sense, like, how much they are beating themselves up,
yes,
after a particular thing? If that time frame is receding, they're making progress?
Well, mind sees it like that.
Yeah.
Mind thinks in terms of progress.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, but then it sees that, oh, progress is happening, I'm improving, and then another reaction happens another day, and then it says, oh, mm-hmm, I'm back now.
Back to square one.
Back to square one. So, but what I see is that whatever happens, happens in the moment, and nobody has any control over that, you know. But once the awareness is seen, once the invocation of love or your being has happened, nothing sticks.
Yeah.
It doesn't stick.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's the greatest gift to humanity, because you showed the taxi driver the love of yourself, which calms him down too. So you both, by showing up as yourself, you diffuse a lot of confrontation.
Yeah.
It's diffused.
Yeah. It is the recognition that the anger, the provocation, also comes from that love. It is not separate from that love.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. It's the compassion for the taxi driver. It's the compassion for those that drive us into war, right?
Yeah.
And once you know yourself, you understand all other selves. Well, you know all other selves, and you understand why it is that they're doing what they're doing, because they have forgotten the love of their self, right? And when you come home to yourself, you lose the ability to hate and harm. It's just not in, it's not there anymore. There's no desire to get ahead or conquer, so to speak, in any way. And it doesn't mean that life stops, yeah. Right? Life keeps going. You might be, quote unquote, getting ahead still, right? And
right.
Your job or, you know, in society and somehow. And that's what's happening, but you're not, you don't expect anything out of it anymore. That's, yeah. It's just playing out as life itself.
Yeah, you put it beautifully. It's just playing out. I mean, there's full engagement, but there's no involvement. The ego involvement is not there.
Yeah.
And I think that's what creativity is all about. Mm. All the creative expressions, the genuineness that comes out of it is beautiful.
So, completely different topic. There's also some way of relating or saying, you want something?
No, nothing.
Yeah, sure.
I'm done, yeah. Please.
Some way of saying or relating in certain sections of the society, of the spiritual progress. It's like mind integration, heart integration, and
दीदी कैमरा है वहाँ पे ठीक है आप जाओ कोई बात नहीं
बॉडी इंटीग्रेशन इज देयर समथिंग लाइक दैट इज इट लाइक प्रोग्रेस और इज इट लाइक रिलेटेड और व्हाट एग्जैक्टली डज इट मीन
सी इट इज ऑल अ हैपनिंग लाइक आई सी इट ऑल एज अ हैपनिंग द फॉर द एंटिटी There is always this concern with progress and, you know, somehow we want to progress at something. So we keep imagining that this is happening, that is happening. But at the same time, like, what I feel is the benchmark, so as to speak, although there is no benchmark, but just to, you know, give it a conceptual explanation, the peace is the only benchmark, which has been told by everyone, whether it's Ramana Maharshi or Ramesh Balsekar or Nisargadatta Maharaj, he would say peace, if you are feeling peaceful day by day, peaceful meaning that even when the circumstances are challenging, even when you have financial problems or health problems, even then you experience that peace. So that peace never eludes you.
Mm.
And that itself brings a sense of relief, that itself brings an end to the seeking. Otherwise, yes, I mean, there are a lot of teachings, a lot of concepts where they teach how to integrate and this. Now, under good conditions, everything is, you know, everything feels peaceful. You know, the body feels integrated with mind. But, you know, when when the mind is turbulent or when the external circumstances change, then first, you know, the ego comes up with this thought that I have lost it. I have lost my peace. The very basis of that thought is being, is love.
Mm.
So it's never lost as such. So this path, this teaching is not about improving the person in any way. It is simply this inquiry into what is this, what is the source of it all. So everything is arising, but where is it arising from? If you think that it is arising from a separate entity, then of course the cycle continues, you know, the cycle of pain and pleasure. Then you are bound to karma, right? then you will believe when you're bound to karma, then there are a lot of other concepts also that come with it.
Yeah.
But the moment you know that even the separate entity is only a thought, it's a conceptual thought, it's an arising, that itself is freedom, then there's not much concern with it. So yes, some days the body will feel integrated with the mind and the mind will be peaceful, it will be accepted. There are other days when the mind will not be very peaceful. That is also accepted. So as Scott was saying, that it is surrender to what is. That in a nutshell is Advaita. Complete surrender to what is.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be forced. It cannot be given by anybody. It is an invocation. It happens through the grace. And all one experiences after that is gratitude. Immense sense of gratitude.
Was your question based around what experiences, how do you know if you're making progress in this? So what I experienced was when something happened, when a situation happened, I expected my mind and body to act in a certain way. And that's who I was, you could say. A situation happened and this body, the sense, the feeling and the thoughts, whatever came out of that was who I was. When those started to die down, when the expectations of, if say somebody cut me off in traffic and I would feel a, when that started to die down, when the expectation wasn't aligning with the experience of my mind and body, meaning, and it was starting to deplete towards peace, that's what I would say is an experiential progress, because you're surrendering to what is.
Or feeling closer to the heart.
Yes, right. That's just another way of saying, you know, you could say they were your vasanas, right? They push you around. Those vasanas are just depleting, dissolving into being, which is peace. And then you don't expect, and then the expectations start to go away. You don't expect your mind and body to react in certain ways anymore, because they don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
So then all of a sudden in the end, there is no expectation anymore. Mm-hmm. There just is. Mm-hmm. And that's peace and love.
Yeah, then let's tee it up like FAQs. So there's also another way of dealing with the quest of spirituality in the West through, let us say, experiences, our unified experiences, like whether it is plant medicine, ayahuasca, or cocoa ceremonies and shaman things, right? How far are they helpful? Is it necessary at all? Is it recommended in some cases or certain cases? I don't know whether you would be able to.
I think Scott will be able to answer this one.
How did you know? Is it that obvious?
No, actually, I don't have any experience with any such thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have barely had, the only thing I've had is beer in my life.
Yeah. Mm.
And that too, I can count the times I've had beer.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, it just didn't agree with me to change anything. Like for me, this experience, whatever it is, whichever way it is, I never want to change or alter it. Sometimes it can be extremely excruciatingly painful.
Mm.
but I don't change it. But that's my personal thing. Yeah. Now, I don't see it as right or wrong. So I won't say that if somebody has tried something or had an experience through that, that that is wrong. That's not my view.
But it would help. Would it help?
Maybe. Okay. It could be. If it also, what I feel is that it also depends on the person's psychological maturity. Like if someone has done some sort of self-reflection or some sort of spiritual work, and then they are trying those things out, then it will be a different experience. But someone who just wants to experience, just for the sake of experiencing something, goes into it, that thing can sort of, that thing may have a different effect. Like, because I was speaking to a psychotherapist in the US, and she told me that she had been to Peru 2 times and had ayahuasca. But even after that, she said it just didn't change anything for me. I had all the visions, the Mother Goddess came, everything, I was shown everything, but still I'm back, and still my problems are the same. But yes, there are other people also who say that they have had a profound insight shift also.
But it's just another experience. It's an epic, it's a profound experience. I did take a heroic dose, you'd call it, of LSD, and I had somebody hold space for me. And it was beyond the imagination, right? It's the most epic experience you can have, but it's still an experience. Yeah. You know, this goes back to, you know, Ram Dass brought this to light, right? He said it's wonderful, except there's one problem. You come down, right? And it's you, and it's that coming down where the wonderful thing about LSD or psilocybin or any of those types of drugs is that it does last for a long time, months, 6 months, 12 months, where you are in line. But what happens, because you don't understand, if you're not in this message, if you don't understand, the ego will start to come back into play slowly, 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 and then you end up back where you started from. And this message of Advaita, there's an end. Right, a permanent end to the cycles of samsara. Yeah. And so I would say relative to LSD would be, it would open you up to the possibility that when you did hear this message of Advaita, Jnana, that you would be like, oh, that I need more of that. Like, I need more of that. So yes, I think it has a profound purpose, but it in itself cannot lead to self-realization. Right, by doing it, by being high on it, you will not. I'm not quite sure why, because there are instances in it where you literally become objects or concepts. We talked about this. Like, I became calculus. There was not a doubt in this that I wasn't that. And, you know, you hear people saying, I became God. But there's not a bridging, there's still a little gap there, because who was aware that you were God, right? You're not, I haven't never heard anybody say, I became awareness. You're always, I became something.
That's interesting. I think that's therein lies the real truth.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Nisargadatta Maharaj said that it is the background which is facilitating all these experiences that is missed, which is illuminating, because generally what happens is people get caught up in the experience, and like for the ego mind, that may seem something amazing. It may seem like an achievement. I mean, I get some emails where people ask that I've had that bliss and I want it over. I want it again.
Yeah.
And I've been trying for so many years doing this meditation, that meditation, this practice, mm-hmm. and it's not happening.
Yeah.
And it's like what is obvious is missed over there. That's why the chase is happening.
Chasing experiences, yeah.
Yeah, even the experience which gave you the high was actually pointing to the peace which is very neutral.
Yeah.
What Ramana Maharishi would say, it's your natural state. So, one time I was just meditating in this room. And I don't know, I went a little deep and a lot of time passed. I didn't get to know. My family got worried because the door was locked. So, after some time, you know, I heard knocking and banging. Then I slowly came out of it. And then I opened the door and then they said, you've been here for 3.5 hours, 4 hours. What were you doing inside? So, and that felt very good. That felt like a lot of bliss. But that after that, I was quite miserable because I kept trying to
get back into that.
So I was like, now I want to experience this, that once I'm completely into that, then I will be peaceful for eternity.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what this is all about. So,
but there's a bridging there that when you turn your attention into the source in which I arises out of, and that attention merges in being, right? So it I arises out of being. When that attention turns into being and rests in being, that is a non-objective experience of bliss.
Yeah.
Right? So there is a somewhat place you're trying to get to.
Yeah.
Right? Because if not, then why am I doing anything? Right, if it's not going to be different from the suffering, why am I attempting anything?
True.
It's a non-objective experience of being resting in and as itself. Right, and that's bliss.
True.
So, you just have to. When I speak to people, I'm just making it very clear. It's a non-objective experience that this can't get.
Yeah.
If this knows it, it's not it. If you can describe it, it's not it.
It's not
in any way. Besides, again, we're going to come back to peace and contentment and satisfaction and wholeness and all of those words we're after, but it's still not that.
Yeah, still not that. But the interesting thing is that it sort of bridges the gap because you never forget the glimpse. You know, whatever mm-hmm. whatever that is always an, you know, I don't know how to put it in words, that awareness is always there then. Even when you're having an interaction, this becomes evident that this is here. It is here, it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the more you struggle with it, try to achieve it, attain it, that is where...
The paradox, the counterintuitiveness, where the mind cannot get that, that's where the mind struggles. How can I let go? How can I do no thing? How can I become effortlessness? It's nonsensical.
Yeah.
And it's... letting that be okay, right? That it is nonsensical, because it's completely nonsensical.
I think Ramesh, he explained the concept very beautifully. It's like the ego is so immersed in doership. At some point, it realizes that all doership is futile. So it says that if I'm not the doer, then who is this me?
Mm.
You know, that question comes up, which is basically self-inquiry.
Mm.
And at that point, there is total silence, you know, because the moment you say that I am this or I am not that, you're still identifying with the movement. But the moment you know that there's nothing can be done now, it's like a surrender, you know, that like the way child surrenders, the state of the child. So in that, the entire thing, the awareness, or whatever you want to call it, it just opens up. And you realize the magnitude, the infinite magnitude. Then after that, there's nothing actually that can be said about it. Nothing can be done about it. So yes, you were right, you know, from the very beginning, that words fall short in this. But yes, it is beautiful to point. Yeah. It is beautiful to point, it is beautiful to listen, and that's why it happens, that's why the teachings happen.
Yeah, that's the compassion.
That's the compassion.
I don't know how much liberty we can take of you, I mean, time-wise.
I mean, I've kept myself free for you, so no, it's not a problem with me.
Okay, awesome.
That's why, you know, I said, it's always beautiful to talk about one. We can spend the entire day talking about it, but, I mean, of course, I know you guys
okay.
have plans.
So I have to travel all the way to India to have this conversation.
Yeah. No, it's really wonderful to see you. It's really wonderful to see you. See you both, in fact. You know, I mean, Ravi has been, I've seen him in the talks as well, and it's good.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's beautiful.